Hey, good afternoon, Juno. It's a few seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Juneau Afternoon, Pat Moore, your host today, and we're going to have a bunch of nice guests with us today. Sanjay Piare is here from the University of Alaska Southeast. He's going to be talking about his Evening at Egan presentation tonight. Chuck Smythe and Zachary Jones will drop in, an overview of the Native American Heritage Month lecture and film series. Dave Rubin and Dick Benedict will come by to talk about the First Friday exhibits that they're both mounting at the Alaska State Museum. Kim Naylor will bring Jim Fowler by. His First Friday show this week is about original children's book as illustrations. And Odette Edgar will drop in and tell us about the quilt show at KTOO. The Monday Night Sewing Circle and Gold Street Quilters have quilts up on the walls here at KTOO Studios. So stay tuned for Juneau Afternoon. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Indian Health Service in Shiprock and the New Mexico Tumor Registry are teaming up in an effort to more accurately map tumor rates in Native communities. As Carrie Young reports, the first thing investigators are doing is finding where tribal members without street addresses live.
When collecting location-based data on tumor trends, researchers have traditionally relied on the mailing address provided in a patient's chart to document their residence. But in rural New Mexico, this is often just a P.O. box. Finding an actual home is a bit more challenging.
You know that they're at milepost 15, then you go 8.5 miles and then take the left fork in the road and we're the second house on the left.
Dr. Chuck Wiggins is the director of the New Mexico Tumor Registry. He says accurate residential information is especially useful when looking at cancer rates and possible environmental factors.
As an example, people have wondered whether or not, you know, residents near an old uranium mine or an old uranium facility, whether there's any elevated risk conferred by living close to those facilities. If we could get very specific information, we might be able to better measure how close the person lived to that mine and maybe make a more accurate observation about possible associations.
Wiggins says the IHS may have residential information that the tumor registry doesn't. If the investigators are successful in mapping homes and individuals, the group could expand the effort statewide. For National Native News, I'm Carrie Young.
President Obama signed a proclamation Thursday for the nation to observe November as Native American Heritage Month. In it, Obama expressed his administration's commitment to tribes, noting the upcoming White House Tribal Nations Conference in mid-November. Obama also highlighted many issues, including resolutions over long-standing legal disputes, the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, and the establishment of a White House Tribal Council. Tribes and Native organizations across the country are hosting events during the month. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in Juneau, Alaska is sponsoring a noon lecture series on spirituality. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute President Rosita Worrell says their Council of Traditional Scholars has wrestled with how to bring the knowledge of shamanism into the modern world and to correct public misconceptions. An Alaska court recently heard testimony on Yupik fishing and spirituality, says Worrell, adding to the timeliness for the discussions.
As a society, we still have a lot to learn about Native religion, Native spirituality. We're hopeful that our lecture series is going to offer an insight into Native spirituality and Native religion.
The first talk planned for Tuesday looks at spiritual connections and obligations, the foundation of Tlingit existence. The series will be videotaped and posted online. Athabascan Elder Katie John was remembered and missed last week at the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention in Fairbanks. John was known for fighting for subsistence rights and a long legal battle. Granddaughter Catherine Martin says this was one of the first AFNs she missed. John passed away in May.
She always stood up, you know, for subsistence, but she mostly always stood up for our cultural and our traditional ways. She said, never forget where you came from, never forget who you are. And that was, I think, one of the things that also she used, that why she prevailed.
Fred John Jr. says his mom raised more than a dozen children, her own and adopted.
But we were taught from her really hard and really good way, and she expects us to walk that walk. And I think we are. We're going to carry on for her. The subsistence case and everything remind everybody that it had to go on. Our people had to fight. She belonged to all Alaska now.
John was remembered on the podium by speakers during the convention, including by AFN leadership and U.S. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski. On this day in 2012, the Intertribal Buffalo Council and other groups held the first National Bison Day. This year, U.S. South Dakota Senator Tim Johnson introduced a resolution to designate November 2nd as the day to celebrate bison as a living symbol of the U.S. and recognize the role bison have in Native culture. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. It's 6.5 minutes after 3 o'clock. An interesting thing here, we just got a 12/29 dated Juneau area forecast. And this morning when I got up, the forecast was completely full of snow. It was going to snow every day this week. The word snow does not appear anywhere in this current forecast. And by Thursday, we're supposed to have mostly cloudy without even rain. So I think all of those things are well worth noting and taking a little cognizance of. My first guest on Juneau Afternoon today is a friend of mine from the University of Alaska Southeast, Sanjay Pereira. PRA is here, and Sanjay has an exciting project that I guess you put together over the last couple of years, and it's finally come to fruition. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Yeah. So tell us about this. You're going to do a presentation tonight on it, but what's the Berners Bay Project about?
Well, the origin of the Berners Bay Project is really part of a much bigger grant that we received from the National Sounds Foundation across the University of Alaska system. So the other campuses are involved as well, and the Berners Bay, which is 38 miles north of here, at the end of the road currently right now, and there are three test cases associated with this grant: one on the Kenai Peninsula, one on the North Slope of Alaska, and one in Berners Bay. Mm-hmm. And these are test cases for doing social ecological interdisciplinary research.
Now, you've been working in this area for a while at UAS. There was a long time when you were doing some research that involved mapping mapping sociographic things on maps using satellite data and like that.
Yeah, my background, this is a stretch for me. It involves social science, economics, physical sciences, biological sciences. But although my background was in kind of the biological sciences, when I got into mapping, maps are an integrator of everything, and geography is an integrator of everything. And so it's just been a very natural field for me to gravitate towards and in a research context, too. All of my research is now, really much more interdisciplinary than it used to be, and it involves several disciplines. And this is just an example of that.
I have a feeling, based on a number of studies, that there was a big study of sea otters here this last summer and like that. It seems to me that we are moving toward more interdisciplinary research in the sciences, that the idea of a physicist locking himself in the laboratory and never speaking to anybody outside has kind of gone away.
Yeah, the environment in general for research and for these kinds of things, and where federal dollars go for research, all these things are, these are demands on science, the science community, to really do research that matters. And so that means having links to of the information they're gathering, having more concrete links to the context of all that data. What's the socioeconomic impacts of the information they're collecting? What's the broader relevance of their studies? And so, for otters, a prime example, you can't solve that problem without studying the human side of the equation, the ocean side of the equation, the biology side of the equation, and all of the other changes that are occurring along with that.
In that particular set of studies, I know they also listened to stories from Native elders about the history. And some things that basically were not really normally thought of part of the province of science, but they felt that was really valuable.
It is. And for social ecological research, which has a lot to do with studying how social systems and natural systems are, how their change in either of them is sort of intertwined. And so We can do that by talking about, let's say, climate change, you know, in contemporary time frames, but we can learn a lot more by looking backwards in terms of historical time frames. And so that gives us a much broader window into understand how, let's say, past environmental changes have influenced the decisions we've made as people.
So if you take this to its logical conclusion, then the next thing you do is add a poet to your grant.
It is. and that's dead on, really. For the National Science Foundation has gone through a cultural shift, and they're the predominant funding agency for science, and they demand not just intellectual merit. The top two things you submit with the grant are the intellectual merit of the research you're doing and the broader impacts. And if the broader impacts don't sell and don't resonate with who's reviewing the grant, it's going to be hard to get funded these days. So you
chased these funds for a couple of years, I guess, putting this whole package together. Did this start at UAF, UAA, or UAS? I mean, or was it everybody getting together and saying, let's do this?
We're actually in the fourth phase. We've been working on this grant source, which is called EPSCoR, the Experimental Program to Stimulate Competitive Research. And we're in the fourth phase of it. And the prior phases were mostly disciplinary type work, like microbiology and genetics and the like. And like I said, science is kind of going through the shift of doing interdisciplinary work. And so in the current phase, we shifted to an highly interdisciplinary proposal with social scientists, economists, biologists, physicists working.
Sanjay, since you're going to be working in Berners Bay, are we likely to see you out there? I mean, are you folks going to be out there with some kind of ship or something like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. It turns out that as part of this grant, after we got this grant, the state came forward and bought us a research vessel, little UAS. So, you know, so this is this grant is very much about building capacity and infusing funding and giving you kind of a springboard to get other funding and to collect other resources. And so in that way, yes, we're hoping to have a fairly strong presence up in Berners Bay to have sort of drive a lot of the faculty and a lot of the students to look at Berners Bay as a lab. You know, it's right here in our backyard and it's a gorgeous place to work. And if nothing else for the student experience, I think that's one of the things that's been missing at UAS is, you know, this. We've got the Mendenhall Glacier, but a place like Berners Bay is an awfully cool place for a student to work.
And really hard to take a research vessel up on the glacier, too.
Right.
But I got to know more about this boat. So where is it? Where is it?
Currently, it's in Auk Bay, and so that's where we've got it stationed. And we bought it locally, so a good example of how research dollars can help economics here. And it's going to allow us to do a lot of the work in the shallow estuaries and a little bit upriver, and still access some of the instrumentation we have actually in Berners Bay itself.
What's the name?
That's a good question. We haven't figured that out.
Oh, you both.
But I have an idea of what we want to what we'd like to call it. I'd like to get permission so to do it because it may have a Tlingit name associated with it, and I want to make sure that that's an okay thing to do.
So. Yeah, I'm liking this concept.
Yeah.
So how big?
It is a 23-foot Wold Ridge boat, so just enough to get our students in and out of Berners Bay pretty safely and part of the way up the rivers anyway. So
yeah, hey, this is. And UAS owns this thing.
UAS owns it, yeah.
All right.
So that's not the only thing that's happened. We also hired two new faculty so as a result of this grant. And it's going to fund over 30 undergraduate students over the next 5 years, and it's going to fund probably 6 or 7 graduate students that are working with UAS faculty. So it also funded an outreach coordinator so that we can connect with some stakeholders involved in the research as well. So it kind of provides all these pieces, really, you need to pull off a successful research project. So.
Well, now, people who are interested in learning some more about this have an opportunity tonight at 7 o'clock. As a matter of fact, you're doing a presentation up at the evening at Egan. Are you in the lecture hall?
Yeah, we're going to be in the lecture hall.
Yeah. What? Give me a quick idea of what that's
Yeah, the research
like.
Involves, you know, 15 to 20investigators, you know, primarily researchers across the University of Alaska system and a handful of external cooperators from various agencies. So I'm really going to be speaking for interdisciplinary work that this entire team is doing. I'm going to just kind of give a little bit of context to this idea of social ecological research and why it's interesting and why people should be interested in general as a good framework to do interdisciplinary research. And then I'm going to just give a few examples on the kinds of things we've collected, the kinds of studies we've done over the last year. They're preliminary, but they're pretty indicative of the kind of work we're going to do. And then I'm going to give a quiz at the end to the crowd.
Oh, okay. So. All right. So and I assume you get a grade and you don't get coffee unless you get a grade, right, at the end of the talk. Okay, good enough. This is tonight's UAS Evening at Egan presentation, Berners Bay. Sanjay Priyari is going to be talking. He's Associate Professor of Geography out at UAS. And part of this 15-member team that's going to be looking at Berners Bay over until 2017, you said.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, what a major project. Well, thanks for coming down and telling us about it. I hope a crowd comes out and hears the story tonight.
Thanks.
This is Bird Note. We're here this early November dawn on the Platte River in central Nebraska. Out of the east, in the first light, flying low above the river's braided channels, comes a small aircraft. You could call it the Platte River Crane Plane. The pilot and two observers are searching for whooping cranes. With a population of just 270, these birds are among the most endangered in North America. Breeding in Wood Buffalo National Park in Canada, the cranes fly south to winter along the coast of Texas. In autumn, they pass through the Platte River Valley, typically during late October and early November. If cranes are spotted, a ground crew hurries to their location to monitor the bird's behavior and document their choice of habitat. This careful observation is made possible by a precedent-setting court ruling, giving endangered wildlife and their habitat legal standing in the use of the Platte River's water. Two planes fly every day between early October and early November. They fly at first light because the cranes, to protect themselves from predators, stand in the river's shallow waters at night. One could do worse than to be, at dawn, an observer of cranes. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
It's just about 18 and a half minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next two guests are here to tell us about a really interesting series of lectures and film series that's going on at the same time. These are part of the Native American Heritage Month, which is, I guess, would be October or November, right, of this year. So with me are Chuck Smythe and Zachary Jones. And guys, give me an idea of what the Alaska Heritage Institute is bringing to us for the month.
We're bringing invited lecturers to town. Three are from around the state, and two are from Juneau. To talk about one topic, Native spirituality, in various manifestations. Two of the lectures are about Tlingit people. No, actually three. And then there's another lady from the North Slope talking about spirituality and trying to revive traditional spirituality in the Barrow area, North Slope. And then we have a professor from Kenai Community College, Alan Boras, who's speaking about a ceremony he witnessed on the Nooshigak River relating to salmon.
I guess I'm wondering, historically, there was a movement during the early times of Alaska to more or less suppress the entire Native culture in Alaska. Is spirituality among Natives, a Native spirituality, alive?
Yes, there's a persistence of a lot of beliefs and practices, although clearly, you know, they don't practice shamanism anymore. In this part of the state, there is a lot of ceremonial activity, September and October and the first part of November are big months for that. And there was just one here last week, for example, in town, the Memorial Kui. And there is persistence of a lot of practices about shamanism in terms of the beliefs in the spiritual nature of human remains and objects, that the shaman's spirit is still present in places where there were burials of shamans and in the objects that may be returned from museums. So these still affect people's lives and are relating to behavioral prescriptions. So,
yeah, go ahead.
This is Zach. I really appreciate that you bring up that issue of history. This is a really important topic to talk about today, but it does contain a historical baggage. In the United States, we often talk about, we have this this sort of self-evident principle of the freedom of religion, that many, many people, it's an important part of their life. But when we speak about this principle applied to the Native American community in history, it's a very complex situation. There were many laws made that forbade freedom of religion for Native Americans. And you mentioned this these efforts, certainly there were a lot of top-down laws and pressures, but I really like that you asked that question, are these still alive? Very much so. Amid all these difficulties, these communities have really just, they've retained their strength, and they've moved forward in a very respectful way. And it's great to have these wonderful people talk about that in a very real sense about how things are today.
I notice on November 18th, Dr. Rosita Worrell is going to be talking actually about Tlingit spirituality and shamanism. So she's addressing the questions, I guess, almost directly in her lecture.
Yes, relating to the behaviors and the continuing beliefs in the efficacy of shamanic spiritual places, as I was saying, the beliefs that spirits inhere in shamanic objects that we find today, people have to behave towards them in certain ways, and sometimes receive blessings, but a lot of times if they don't, they have to be careful of suffering misfortune. So, those kinds of practices are still evident. And just a few weeks ago, I heard of an incident like that in Haines relating to a shaman's grave up there about an individual who was consulting with a federal agency about it. And some members of his family were suffered some kinds of misfortune just talking about it.
I'm wondering how much, whether the belief exists that as newcomers to Alaska, we are affected by the same thing, whatever you want to call the people who are not First Natives. In other words, do the Natives see this shamanistic belief or these spiritual beliefs as applying to me as well?
Less so. I mean, we as non-natives, have a different belief system, and so that tends to protect us, and we're sort of not, I don't know, susceptibility is the right word, but we don't delve deeply into that kind of relational cosmos that they reside in. And so for us, it's more about kind of learning what it means to Native people. That's one of the reasons we wanted to have this series, so that people can understand what respect means, which is a very different, very complex and multidimensional concept in the Native world, applying to not just relationships between human beings, but relationships with places, relationships with the spirits of animals and fish and birds and things, and just, many more to ancestors and to people coming after us. It's a very different kind of concept than we have, where we think of it in terms of just sort of behavior, in terms of proper behavior.
Yeah. Well, during the month of November and into the first week in December, you have a chance really through this lecture series to sort of immerse yourself in this business. You have a really enthusiastic agenda of folks who are going to be coming up to talk. Could you give us an idea of whom we might hear?
Some of the people we can expect to hear from through this lecture, we will start off with Steve Langdon. He's a professor of anthropology at UA, and he's going to talk a little bit about what the Tlingit cosmos is and how really Tlingit spirituality affects everyday life and practice. He's a fantastic scholar on the subject and very well respected.
Now, all of these lectures are in the same place. Where will they be held?
Yeah. I think that's a good point. Yeah, these lectures are going to be held every Tuesday of next month, excluding we have one Monday lecture on Monday.
This month now.
Oh, it is.
As of today.
It's November already, yes. Every Tuesday of this month, excluding Monday the 18th, from noon to 1 in the Sealaska building. That's fourth floor. The whole public is invited to come in. We would love to have people come in and see the show. Of course, we realize not everybody will be able to make it, so these lectures will be recorded and placed online so people can watch them later, and really so they can continue to give back and promote cross-cultural education and exposure.
But if you want to come, you can bring a bound bag and like that. So the first one is on November 5th, and that's the Spiritual Connections and Obligations, Foundations of the Tlingit Existence, Steve Langdon. And then on November 12th,
Jana Hacharik is speaking about reclaiming traditional spirituality on the North Slope. And she's a Inupiaq from Barrow and very active up there as a teacher and administrator in the Department of Education. Comes from a whaling family, comes from a very traditional background. Then on Monday, November 18th, which is the only Monday lecture departing from the, actually in addition to the schedule, is President of Sealaska Institute, Rosita Wuerl, and she'll be speaking about Tlingit spirituality and shamanism and the persistence of those beliefs today, as we already mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Tuesday, the following day, November 19th, Professor Alan Boris will be speaking about the great blessing of the water, the salmon, and indigenized orthodoxy on the Nooshagak River relating to the great blessing of the water ceremony, which he witnessed in 2011.
Now, Alan Boris is part of the Kenai Peninsula College faculty, I think.
Yes, and he's been there a very long time, since I actually remember in the early 80s, a very well-known scholar of that area, Athabascan and Nooshagak area, Yupik.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, the following Tuesday, David Katzik, again, a clan leader, Shungu KD leader from Juneau, speaking again about concepts of respect and Tlingit spirituality. He's a very, not only dynamic, but an expert speaker in conveying traditional concepts to kind of non-native people in a way that really opens up doors of perception, so to speak, in understanding those kinds of experiences.
Now, simultaneously with this, there's an Alaska Native film series that's being run along the same way. I think Lance Twitchell is doing the introductions and moderating the discussions afterward. Do you have a schedule for those? Well, I do. So on November 6th is a movie called Survival Prayer. I don't know where these are being held. They're University of Alaska Southeast. So they're probably in the University of Alaska Lecture Hall, would be my bet. That's the best place to show films up there. So on November 6th is Survival Prayer. November 13th, We Were Children. This is a Canadian production about First Nations children. People of a Feather and Last Days of Shishmaref is on November 20th. And then the last one of those is December 4th, which is a program called Skins, about Sioux Indians on the Sioux Indian Reservation. It's a 2002 film by Chris Iron, based on a novel of the same name by Adrian Lewis. So this film series operates kind of in conjunction with the lecture series that is being run at the Sealaska Institute.
Yeah, this is all associated with Native Heritage Month in November, which is celebrated every year by, you know, sort of proclamation by the President of the United States to celebrate the heritage of Native
Americans. It's nationwide, we should mention.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, are there other activities that you know of that are going to be held in the Juneau area during the month?
I don't know. I think usually there's probably some events at the State Museum, but this year, because they're closed and are moving, I suspect there aren't any there.
Well, they haven't actually closed yet, but they're that's imminent, yeah. Okay, good. Well, the National Native Heritage Month, the month of November, wonderful series of lectures. Again, these are all held on Wednesday, on Tuesday, except for one that it had to be on a Monday, and they're all at the Sea Alaska building on the fourth floor.
In the boardroom.
In the boardroom, and so and it's bound bag lunch. They're scheduled from 12 to 1, and you're welcome to bring along a bag and sit in and immerse yourself in Native spirituality for the month. Thank you, guys. Little possibility here for the month of November.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 1st of November, 2013. Today is All Saints' Day. It was on this day in 1512, Pope Julius II displayed Michelangelo's paintings on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel for the first time, paintings it had taken Michelangelo 4 years to complete, scenes from the Old Testament, including the famous center section, The Creation of Adam. Michelangelo was 33 at the time, and he was not anxious to do this work. He tried to point out to the Pope that he was a sculptor and not really a painter, but the Pope would not listen. And so Michelangelo used his skills as a sculptor to make a two-dimensional ceiling look like a series of three-dimensional scenes. He worked from a scaffold 60 feet above the floor, covering about 10,000 square feet of surface. Every day, fresh plaster was laid over part of the ceiling, and Michelangelo had to finish painting before the plaster dried. The Arecibo Observatory in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, opened on this day, 1963, the largest single-aperture telescope ever built, with a diameter of 1,000 feet. It's close to the equator, so it can see, by way of radio waves, all the planets in the solar system, and it led to the first discovery of planets outside our solar system. A few years ago, it began collecting data in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, looking for deliberate radio or optical signals from other planets. The U.S. Weather Bureau made its first forecast on this date, 1870. Weather Bureau had first been a part of the Army, and on November 1st, 1870, at 7:35 in the morning, 24 observers across the country made their weather observations, transmitted them to Washington, D.C. by telegraph, and a week later, they issued their first storm warning. Eventually, the Weather Bureau moved to the Department of Agriculture and then to the Department of Commerce. The first medical school for women opened on this day, 1848, in Boston, started by Samuel Gregory. It was called the Boston Female Medical College. Samuel Gregory wasn't really a supporter of women's rights, but he believed it was unseemly for male doctors to assist women in childbirth. So the college mostly served as a school for midwives at first. Here's a poem for today by Barbara Crooker, entitled All Saints. It's one day past the Day of the Dead, and this has been a bad year, 6 funerals already and not done yet. But on this blue day of perfect weather, I can't muster sadness, for the trees are radiant, the air thick as Cairo warmed in a pan. I have my friend's last book spread on the table, and a cup of coffee in a white china mug. All the leaves are ringing like the tiny bells of God. My mother, too, is ready to leave. All she wants now is sugar, panuche fudge, tapioca pudding, pumpkin roll. She wants to sit in the sun, pull it around her shoulders like an Orlon sweater, and listen to the birds in the far-off trees. I want this sweetness to linger on her tongue, because the days are growing shorter now, and night comes on so quickly. A poem by Barbara Crooker, All Saints,
from her collection Gold, published by Cascade Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
24 minutes before 4 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon, and my next guest is a children's illustrator, which I think is a wonderful thing to do because it opens up a whole new world for art. Jim Fowler is here. And, Jim, you're doing a show tonight as part of First Friday.
Yes, at the Arts and Humanities Council Gallery. Mm-hmm. There's an opening tonight at 4:30 until 7:00.
You've illustrated a number of books about Alaska, and I noticed a number of books about the ocean as well. You have a wonderful relationship with dolphins, I think. Anyway, I'm curious because you also do landscapes. I don't want to use the term serious art, but I need a way to separate those two worlds because we were talking before we opened up the mics about the shift that you have to go through in order to get your head around where a child is going to look at your art.
There is a difference. There's an intellectual challenge that illustrating a book offers that I enjoy, and the just taking someone else's words and putting images with them that help those words flow. Plus, I like to add my own little touches, or just little, I call them subtext, especially a child can just follow through. They're just a mouse should continue from page, will be repeated or something. And the one of a kind pieces are it's very immediate, and so there's it's not that they're less thought out, but that process is very different. It's more of a response to what's in front of you, as opposed to sticking with a script. And And staying with that script, but making it, I'm vain enough to want to add my own touches. So.
You've illustrated for a number of other of different children's authors.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe a little bit the relationship that you have to work through with the author?
My wife writes, and that mm-hmm. relationship is one thing.
And fraught with great danger, I'm sure.
Mostly I deal with art directors, and I think only once have I had real contact with an author during the book creation
process. So you receive the book in its finished written form, and then you illustrate the
concepts on the page. I get a manuscript,
yeah.
And some publishers provide me with a galley so that they actually typeset just long strips of text, and the number of pages is generally agreed on prior, and so I go through and break up the text and then decide how I'm going to illustrate them. And I, through the process of just rough sketches and a dummied up book, I communicate with the art director.
I see. There is a review process, and they say, yeah, we like this idea, maybe different here, or something like that?
Yeah. And it varies from art director to art director. I've been fortunate enough to have a lot of freedom with people I worked with. So,
One of the images that people associate with children's books is someone reading the book to a child and then showing the illustrations to a crowd of children surrounding them on the floor and like that. When you're putting the drawings together, are you thinking of that? Is that part of the process that you're shooting for?
What I'm aware of is that children are very observant, and just hyper observant, and so I do like to add little things that I know that they will pick up on that maybe the adult reading them won't. Mm-hmm. But there's still a kind of an internal process that I'm kind of illustrating for me as much as I am for a child. I don't just have a vision of my head of a 5-year old's and try to work towards that child. Mm. So, yeah.
Well, Jim, your show is at the Jack, and it's going up at 4:00 this afternoon, 4:30 this afternoon.
4:30.
Yeah, 4:30. So everyone has a chance to come over. You've been going to be over there to kind of wander through the tables with folks
as long as the food holds out.
Okay. Nicely done. Okay, so the show is Jim Fowler's Illustrations of Children's Books up on the walls of the Jack Gallery tonight for First Friday this week. 13 children's books. And by the way, congratulations. I understand you won the Christopher Award for I'll See You When the Moon is Full.
Yeah, that was a real treat.
Okay, well, looking forward to a chance to walk through your show tonight.
Department of Public Safety. Every Alaskan deserves to be safe and free from domestic violence and sexual assault in our homes, relationships, and communities. If you or someone you love is a victim of violence, there is help available through local shelters and other programs supported by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. The Council even supports intervention programs aimed at helping those who commit domestic violence. Violence is never a solution. Respect is always the right choice.
Brought to you by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Uncle Jeff, what's that?
That, little Billy, is a record.
What's it do?
Well, it goes round and round, and music comes out.
Out of that little hole? Wow.
Remember records? The KTOO used record CD and video sale is coming soon. Saturday, November 2nd from 9 a.m. till noon at the KTOO building at the corner of Egan Drive and Whittier Street.
It's about 18 minutes, 17 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. And my next guest is Dave Rubin, and Kim Naylor's brought him over here. And I guess this is a First Friday exhibit that's opening up at the Alaska State Museum. Is that right?
That is correct. We have three exhibits opening tonight. We have David Rubin, and also...
Hello. Just move that right up close to the... Yeah, thanks.
We also have... solo artist Dick Benedict, title of his show is From Out. And finally, we have 10 Years of Alaskan Art, an exhibit of selections from a decade of works acquired through the generous support of the Rasmussen Foundation Art Acquisition Fund.
Well, you're just going all out for First Friday, aren't you?
We are. We've got three fabulous shows up.
Is it? And it's free, right?
They're all free. Yeah. And just a couple notes. At 5 o'clock, we have Anthony Malott from the Rasmussen Foundation. He's a board member, and he is going to do a small talk right at 5 o'clock for the opening of that exhibit. So it's wonderful that he can make it to our opening. And then also, I'm going to quickly just take a moment and let everybody know that David Rubin is also doing a youth activity tomorrow, and he's going to be teaching classical drawing.
Portraiture
drawing, and there's still some space in our afternoon high school slot, and that goes from 1 till 3.
Oh, so what are you gonna do in those sessions?
Well, I'm gonna show them an approach to drawing portraits. We'll do a little copying of some older classical drawings, and then we're gonna work from a live model in costume. Costumes provided by Aaron from the museum. I guess he's involved with theater here.
Aaron Elmore.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. The drawings I've selected for the kids to work from are from Elizabethan, 1500s, 1400s. And the costumes Aaron brought also are. So the live model will be wearing similar clothes to the drawings they'll be working from.
So when you say an approach to portraiture, mm-hmm. can you describe this approach a little bit?
Well, it starts off with measurements.
Oh, okay.
Like from top of the head to the chin, and the sort of constants that exists, you know, with every face. You know, I always say, yeah, having a formula in art is, you know, is antithetical. But I always say, like with the kids I'm teaching, like with human being, gestation goes through exactly the same formula every time, and every time it ends up with something different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the same thing. I mean, there's certain, the eyes are halfway between the top of the head and the chin. You can use a ruler and see. Why not, you know, give yourself that advantage? Because lots of times, the first approach, when people do a portrait, lots of times, they'll start with details, like the eyes. They're immediately working on the eyes, and there's no outline of a head or anything. And I always say it's like trying to nail trim around the window as the first stage in building a house. You can't possibly nail on the finished
trim. What a wonderful
trim.
Image.
I mean, you have to do this. There's a certain sequence that has to be followed physically. There's no other way around it. So I always say, like, and what always happens when you're first doing, starting out that way, you finally get the end of the drawing, and the eye you started with maybe looks really good, but it's not going with the rest of the face because you really kind of fell into a rhythm with the rest of the face. And that first eye, even though it's so nicely drawn, you don't want to erase it. It's just ruining the whole picture. It's not going. So if you get those things mapped out first, is all I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And it really helps.
So, and you've done this with other students?
Oh, yeah.
Other
artists in residence program, Ketchikan, is pretty busy.
What kind of response do the kids have when you first tell them that they're going to do portraiture? Are they convinced at the outset that they can't do it?
Maybe some. It's going to be too hard. But they just accept what you're telling them, and they try it. And I have a map like that they can see that will apply to the drawings they're going to copy, so they can see how that fits. And sometimes it's surprisingly amazing what they're able to do, and, you know, explain clearly. The advantage of having art in school is I had some college kids once, and I said, okay, draw an oval for the egg, you know, for the an egg shape for the head.
Huh?
Now draw a line halfway between the top and the bottom. And they put this line way up by the top. I said, no, divide it in half. And they thought they had.
Huh.
They didn't understand. I said, no. I had to do it like, put your finger up here, put your thumb over here, and then keep your hand the same and move it so you have the same amount
mm-hmm.
above the line as below the line. And then when their hand keeps in the same position, they kind of learn to understand it first for the first time. I couldn't believe it. They didn't understand what half was.
Dave, there's a classic book called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that she talks about in the book is that many children are basically taught that they don't have the gift of being able to do art. And so they wind up drawing stick figures all their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like one of the things you're working on here addresses that very concept, because her ideas are really simple, you know, turn the picture upside down and draw it without thinking
right.
about what the shape is and stuff like that.
Yeah. I do a similar thing with what we call in the field negative spaces,
uh-huh.
like the space, like in a horse, for instance, the space between the legs.
Yeah.
So actually, I've done it where I cut out the shapes of the in-between forms, and I give them that, and I say, okay, arrange this somehow to make a horse. So they're busy trying to put them together as like that they're positive
mm-hmm.
forms,
mm-hmm.
you know, shapes.
Yeah.
And then finally come over and you do it, and they see
it's a great exercise.
In the space that's not, you know, it's being described by these negative shapes as a horse, and that's always a good lesson, you know. But the kids, they can really take in a lot.
So we're going to see your stuff tonight, and you're opening up an exhibit, and then there's two others, Dick Benedict, and you gave me the third, and I didn't write it down.
The third one, it's Rasmussen Retrospective.
Yeah, okay.
So
okay.
It's the work that we've been able to purchase with Rasmussen funds over the last 10 years. It's a selection of those works. And,
okay. And then this talk is at 5 o'clock?
Talk is at 5 o'clock, and... again, the other artist, Dick Benedict, he's a tempera and oil painter
mm-hmm.
and beautiful paintings. So.
Egg tempera on
panel,
yeah. So, yeah, interesting. Okay, one last question, I guess, Dave, before you go, and that is, how do you feel about being part of three shows at the same time?
Yeah,
comfy
I'm excited
with that?
To be here on the first Friday.
It's a great opportunity to bring a bunch of people in and give you a chance.
It's a beautiful evening, too. It's amazing.
Yeah, and your class tomorrow is at what time?
10 to 12.
10
and
to 12.
From 1 to 3.
And the 1 to 3 is the high school, and there's still slots open in the high school section. Okay, good. No charge
it's
for
like
the class.
Now.
Is there a charge for the class?
No, I believe that's free.
Good. All right.
And the supplies are amazing. I'm really grateful for what the museum has provided.
Okay. Real good. Great opportunities at the state Alaska State Museum. By the way, when's the closure date?
We close March 1st next year.
Oh, a ways off.
Oh, sorry.
We got months and months of museum.
We're open through February.
Okay.
And then we close March, and we've got 6 weeks to move objects.
Outstanding.
So,
okay.
And I know you're friends with Aaron. He just left his play opens tonight.
His play opens tonight. It's hand me the thing real quick.
And I'll, I don't have anything.
Oh, okay.
For him.
I thought you had it. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
So it's at over Trinity and all the usual customers and everything like that.
Yeah.
I know his slide is wonderful. He says tickets are available at all the bookstores. Anyway, it's great. Great little comedy and.
Dying to see it. I saw it last night.
They are an amazing group, aren't they?
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and
I
hope the show goes well.
You're welcome.
Tonight on 360 North at 8, Evening at Egan welcomes Dan O'Neill, author of A Land Gone Lonesome, An Inland Voyage Along the Yukon River. At 9:30, Our American Family visits a family transitioning from rural to city life. Great Decisions in Foreign Policy is at 10, followed by Platts Energy Week, This Week in Defense News, and BioCentury This Week. It's a great way to look at public affairs tonight on 360 North and 360North.org.
It's about 7 minutes before 4 o'clock, and Odette Edgar just walked into the studio and is going to bring us up to date on what's hanging on the walls around KTOO's studios here. About a week ago, I think, or a little longer than that, quilts suddenly started appearing at every turn.
That's right. We hung this latest batch of quilts on Monday night, but we had a show up the month before this that was personal quilts. And these are quilts that we have made for children that are going to be donated to children, either in state foster care or at the AWARE shelter.
So who's the we?
The we is two different groups, the Monday Night Sewing Circle that I'm a part of. And we've been doing these quilts since 1998, making about a dozen quilts every year. And then the Gold Street Quilters, which meet on Saturdays at McFeeters Hall, also make quilts. And they have 16 quilts in the show. And the Monday group has 11. So there's a lot of quilts up. Very colorful.
Define a quilt.
Well, I would call it an artwork done in fabric. And it has a front and batting and a backing and a binding. And then it's all held together with some sort of quilting puts those layers together. And traditionally, they were used on beds, but they have become something that can be hung on the wall or used as a tablecloth. They have lots of different uses.
Do you buy, when you're setting out to make a quilt,
yes.
Do you go buy a piece of fabric and cut it up into chunks, or do you get a kit of pre-cut fabric, or how does a quilt start?
Well, either one of those ways, but I think most of us, the Monday night group, we pick fabrics that we like, maybe out of our own stash, or we go to the store and one of our fabric stores and pick a couple of fabrics and then start working with them, have a design, a blocks design in mind, and then start building from there. Now, the Gold Street group does it completely differently, and it's really fun to see what they do with their quilts because their fabric is all donated.
Hmm.
So they are working with all kinds of strange and unusual fabrics, so they have a very stiff challenge to turn them into something beautiful. And they have done a great job. They've done a great job. They have two or three quilts that actually have ginghams in them, and gingham is those little tiny checks like Dorothy.
Like appeared at my door last night Dorothy
from
the
Wizard of Oz
was one of the most popular children's costumes this year in our neighborhood.
Well, some of those fabrics have turned up in the Monday night quilts, and they have done just really fun things with them because they're kind of, in themselves, are kind of dull and predictable. You know, mm-hmm. they're just a check, but they're very fun. There's some tessellations, and there's just a variety of things that they have done. Very fun.
My wife is a knitter, and there's an online community of knitters. It's huge, all over the world. Is the same thing true of quilting? Are you an internet presence at this point?
I'm not, but there are a lot of people that are. There's a quilting guild in Juneau that has a really amazing website with a newsletter, and you know you can certainly buy fabrics online. And there's lots of patterns available online. So it's like any hobby. It's out there. People love doing it, and they want to share it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If someone was interested in joining you and starting in on their fabulous life of quilting on and on, how would they join the Monday night quilting group?
Well, let's see.
I'm assuming you meet on Monday nights.
Yeah, we meet on Monday nights. Yes.
It was a dead giveaway.
Right. And we meet in people's homes. So, you know, we have about 20 members, and we don't all come every time. But, you know, contact me, Odette Edgar, 586-1787. The group that meets on Saturday mornings, the Gold Street Quilters, are always looking for new folks. And those quilts are always made, I said they're made out of donated fabrics, but they're also group sewing lessons. And so they're really a great place for people who are beginning quilters, who want to start making quilts but don't quite know what to do. And so Judy Reagan, who kind of leads that group, they do a lot of group projects in which people learn different skills and so that's a really good group too for a new quilter.
So Odette, your show is part of First Friday. People
that's
can
right.
come see it. I guess you open it up what about 4:30?
At 4:30 and till 6:30.
Okay.
And we have punch and cookies as refreshments.
Will you have quilters on hand to explain the art?
We will have
and
quilters
so on
hand to answer questions about the quilt.
All right. Okay. Good enough. Well, thank you very much.
You're
Thanks
welcome.
For filling us in on another First Friday activity.
Of course.
My grandma's patchwork quilt, squares of corduroy and silk, red and green and blue and yellow too on my grandma's patchwork.
You're in tune with KTOO Juneau. We broadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI cable at digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and thank you very much from listeners like you. On Monday, Joan Pardis will be hosting Juno Afternoon. She'll be talking with Milani Shivens about the Mendenhall Loop and Glacier Highway projects. The UAS Drama Club will drop by to talk about the week's activities. Steve Langdon will come in with a preview of the Native American Heritage Month lecture on spiritual connections and obligations that we heard about earlier in the program. And she'll be talking with Anita Maynard Losh to highlight Perseverance Theater's upcoming presentation of Treasure Island. Pat Moore, been your host today for Juno Afternoon. Thank you very much for tuning along with me here, and join me next Tuesday and Friday when I'm hosting both days. Thank you very much.
Red and green and blue and yellow too on my grandma's.